This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Hi everyone, my name's Dev Raga. Now this recording with Aussie Firebug actually went for very, very long time. So we've actually split our chat into two parts and today's episode is part one. Hope you like it. Hello, Aussie Firebug.
How you going, Dev? Pleasure to be here, mate.
I had a chat with Aussie Firebug a couple of years ago at the height of the pandemic when he was actually in the UK. So it's nice to have him back. And this time I will be doing the interview and he'll be the guest. So thanks for joining us. What we'll do is basic sort of few questions, but I really wanted to talk a little bit about how you've enjoyed financial independence, because I think you kind of have enjoyed it and you're sort of working part-time, all that sort of stuff. So a lot to cover in this episode. So you ready?
Let's do it, mate.
Let's get started. Now, if you're new to the channel and want to learn about investing, money, finance, etc., remember the three aims of this episodes and podcast channel: education, entertainment, and empowerment. So, Aussie Firebug, very, very famous in the financial independence world. I think you're also the admin of the Aussie Fire discussion, which I am a part of, and I think a lot of our listeners are. So you have a fair bit of fan base in the healthcare community, which is great. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is your blog has got a very Simpsons theme to it. You've got a lot of Simpsons emojis, a lot of, you know, images from The Simpsons. What's the backstory behind it? I assume you're a big Simpsons fan.
That's a great question, Dev. And I actually think you're the first person to ask me this. I think one other magazine maybe had mentioned it before, but on a podcast, I don't think I've ever spoken about it before. So yeah, Simpsons is my favorite TV show of all time. And I used to read a blog. There was a blog, and I actually looked this up before for this podcast. It's called Living a Fi. And I can't remember if it's a boy or girl that runs it and if they're American or Canadian. It's an international blog. It's not an Aussie one. But long story short, they have a Dr. Doom, you know, the Marvel Comics Dr. Doom character. They have this Dr. Doom picture with pretty much all of their blog posts. And I remember liking that there was like a character in the blog. And I thought, you know, when I started my blog, I'm like, I want sort of a theme in my blog. And I love The Simpsons. I always quote them and love the episodes. And I just, that's what I went with. I'm like, it's going to be Simpsons-based theme blog sort of. And whenever I can put a Simpsons picture or meme or anything like that, I chuck it in the blog.
Fantastic. Look, there's a lot of, I suppose there's some learning experiences from The Simpsons. I used to watch The Simpsons when I was growing up. I don't watch it anymore, but I was a big Simpsons fan. But I suppose there's some sort of financial themes in there. I vividly remember one episode where I think Lisa wants a horse or a pony, and a Homer has to work extra and he goes and buys the pony, and to upkeep it, he has to do night shifts and day shifts. Do you remember that?
Oh, absolutely, mate. And do you know what? I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I've rewatched a lot of those episodes on Disney Plus, and they were so good because not only were they funny and, you know, obviously they were hilarious and it was just good storytelling, but they actually told some real life stories and some common stories that a lot of people in, I guess, America and Australia and everyone watching were going through, but they put the Simpsons spin on it. I mean, now it's just, the storylines are just crazy. I mean, they're still sort of funny, I guess, but the story, the writing of The Simpsons at the start was excellent, especially between seasons about 4 and 8. And I think that's one of the episodes you're referring to when Homer has to work the two jobs and he's fallen asleep during the day. Like, it's just really good storytelling combined with some humor and some wit is what made it one of the best TV shows of all time, in my opinion.
I agree. I sort of lost interest in it when it sort of went a bit crazy as well. And that episode, I guess, resonates with money and finances, where essentially he's working and he's trading his time for income. And he just can't afford the pony, and therefore all he wants to do, like, I'm a dad and all I want to do is make sure that my kids are happy, and I want to do the right thing by them, and I'll do everything and everything possible to protect them and give them what they want. And I think that episode, it just resonates in a lot of people's lives. Yeah, where we're basically trading our time for income, and of course, you know, things may work out, things may not work out, and hence, you know, we are all sort of on this journey of life, and some of us, like you and I, journey of life with some financial backing on board. The interesting thing about your journey is that I think when you first started your financial independence journey, you were really obsessed with some products. You were really obsessed with some fees. And I think one of your blog posts specifically talks about it. And you were really obsessed with cutting expenses. But then you started migrating away from that and started focusing on income, where, you know, you can only cut expenses to zero, but you can increase your income, which is technically an unlimited potential. And I think the exact quote in your blog is, you're a self-confessed tight ass, especially, you know, when you went to London. I think that was a bit of an eye-opener, where you got paid a lot more totally. And you sort of went, well, I can actually make a lot more money. So do you think that now you've got both perspectives, if you had to say one or the other, which would be more important for you, increasing income or cutting down expenses? Ideally, we'd do both. But which one do you think is the most important out of those?
Generally speaking, I would say savings is still the most important part. But there is a cutoff point to where that is true. And then you should probably focus on increasing your income. And you mentioned it there in that question, Dev, that I was very focused on the grinding out. You get to 60% savings rate. I was pretty good getting to there, and I was still living a great life. But then that extra couple of percent, if I got to 70, 75, it started to really impact on my life, and it was very hard to do. And if I could go back in time, I probably would have told myself that there is diminishing returns with savings rate. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not the most important thing, because I still think it is the most important thing. It doesn't matter how much you earn. If you're not a good saver or if you can't save money, you're never going to reach financial independence. So savings is definitely, in my opinion, the most important skill to have. But I think a lot of people in the FIRE community focus too much on the savings and investing part. And from what I've seen, and I've met a lot of people that have reached financial independence, it's the ones that can save money and have a high income that really get there a lot quicker. And the funny thing is they're actually, most people that I've met have told me some really funny stories about losing so much money in investments. Like, they're a subpar investor, but they're really good at savings, and they have a job that earns them a lot of money. And they're the people that seems to get there a lot quicker and seems to be able to do it a lot easier. So it's a balance, but I'd still say savings is the most important, but then diminishing returns after a while, and you should probably start focusing on how you can earn more money. Obviously, it depends on how important financial independence is to you as well. Like, there's nothing wrong with just, you know, chilling in your job if you only have a 20% savings rate or something and you're comfortable with that, but you're loving life and you're eventually going to reach the goal, you know, in your 40s, 50s, 60s maybe. That's cool. Everyone runs their own race. But yeah, I'd say it's not about how much you earn, it's how much you burn. But you do want to start focusing on the income, especially if you're earning below the average income in Australia. I think there is a lot of low-hanging fruits for people that are earning. I think the average or the medium is something like $86,000 or something like that for the full-time Australian employed worker. So if you're earning under that, low-hanging fruit, like, you know, everyone's situation's different, but it's not out of the realm of possibilities. Like, it's very common to hear people job hopping, maybe upskilling, getting a certification, you know, whatever it is, after a year, and then maybe looking for another job and getting paid an extra $20,000, an extra $30,000. And if you think about how long it would take and how hard it would take for you to amass a portfolio to give you an extra $30,000 a year when you could achieve that in maybe 18 months or a year, you know, so that's That's the message I'd say with that.
That's right. I mean, I agree. I mean, savings rate, if you can perfect that early on in your career, then everything else becomes easier. It's very hard to pull 30, 40% returns annually on investments. So where it's relatively, quote unquote, easy to save 30% a year from your after-tax income. So your returns on your income is a lot higher.
And could I just add one more point to that? Sorry, Dev. I think a lot of people really get stuck into their savings rate because it's 100% within your control. So I love the idea of, I think that's where people should start. They're coming in and they're like, all right, I don't really have any idea. You know, I always tell people track your expenses because you don't know how much you're spending. So you don't know how much you need to save to generate enough passive income to fund your lifestyle. It all begins on finding out how much you actually spend to maintain your lifestyle. That's where it begins. But then I think people get too, and this is myself as well, I fell prey to this. You get so caught up in, all right, this is all within my control. I'm going to really try hard to reduce my expenses. And maybe earning more money is a bit scarier because I've got to have that awkward conversation with my boss. Maybe I've got to do something that I'm not comfortable doing. Like if you're in budget and Excel land, you might love doing that. So you just stick doing it. But I think this has been my experience anyway. Every time I've been uncomfortable and I put myself in a situation where I'm not sure how things would pan out, like the London situation, that's where I've seen the biggest growth and the biggest gains, not even just financially, just within my own, like broadening my own horizons. And I would encourage anyone to really try to put yourself in that uncomfortable position because it will leapfrog you towards financial independence. That's been my experience anyway.
Great. Could just, I guess, just dwelling on that a little bit and tell me if this is out of bounds or not. When you did go overseas to the UK and London and spent, I think, 2 years there, is that right?
That's right.
Did you double or triple your income? What was that factor? And if you did increase your income, then did you basically save whatever extra that you made? Because you've already kind of learnt how to live on, I suppose, a lower income in Australia, and you've gone there and let's say you doubled it, then does that mean you saved most of the extra stuff? I mean, barring some travel expenses, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. No questions are out of bounds, Dev. And I actually think that I've put these numbers on my blog anyway. But essentially, the day rate that I was getting as a contractor, I didn't work the whole year because we were traveling so much, but the day rate was close to, I think, 2.5 or like 2.7 what I was getting in Australia. But It's comparing apples to oranges. So the short story is, yes, I got paid way more in London than I was getting paid in Australia. It was more than double my wage. I enjoyed some lifestyle inflation with that. So we were spending so much more money in London because I viewed London as like me and my wife are traveling the world. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity. I'm not here to save money. And we actually, funny enough, did save money because I was earning so much, but that wasn't the goal. So we were going out to restaurants. We were traveling every second weekend. So we did save a little bit, but our expenses were through the roof comparatively to how I was living or how we were living back in Australia the first time around.
Okay, right, sure. I guess the context there, because most of my listeners are healthcare workers, is that as we progress from junior doctors and junior nurses to senior doctors and senior nurses, et cetera, the income does go up. And my sort of general advice to them is, you know, if you can, you know, save a portion of that as the income goes up and start investing it, then, you know, that would be something from a habit perspective would be something good to do. But I suppose if you're going from Melbourne or Victoria to London, your rent, your cup of coffee, everything just sort of skyrockets as well. So everything's in proportion.
Do you know what? Don't get me wrong though, Dev. I was still more frugal than 95% of people, even in my spend mode. And that comes back to your point about when you have ingrained habits, they're very hard to break. So I was breaking a few of them by going out nearly every week. We'd go out for dinner at some place, cafe, we'd meet friends, something, right? Go to the pub, get beers, whatever. But I was still, you know, I'd pack my lunch. I wasn't buying new clothes because I didn't need new clothes. Just like normal things that I do every day, that was still there.
Right. Now, financial independence. So one of the difficulties with what I do as a doctor and a lot of healthcare workers is it's pretty hard to convince people to retire fully. And I think you're with me on this in the sense that I like the FI component, I don't really like the RE component because that gets misconstrued and interpreted as you reach this magical number and all of a sudden you sit by the beach and basically read books or watch YouTube all day. And we all know that's not the whole point of FIRE. What we try to achieve is gives you your time back and you can sort of do what you want to do sort of thing. So have you reached that stage where you're not working full time is my understanding and you just basically work when you want to work and you've got your investments working for you? Is that your sort of lifestyle at the moment? How does your week look?
Yeah, that's basically right. So we've reached the point now, sort of the portfolio is at a point of escape velocity, meaning we don't have to add anything to it and it's going to snowball down the mountain and reach our FI number. We are still adding to it, but it's at the point now where it's not that I hardly care about it, but I care so much less about it now than I did when I first started. Like, it's incomparable the difference I have in mindset. I'm more about lifestyle design and now moving on to the next phase of my life and what I consider to be the retire early component of FIRE. And you touched on it that it gets misconstrued. People think, yes, that we want to sit on a beach and sip pina coladas. And I have not met one person in real life that wants to do that. There are a few people online. I'd say like it's 1% of the community, maybe 5% if I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, that want to do that. But the vast, vast majority of people just want to have more free time in their life. And I think as well, some autonomy over their work, because meaningful work is awesome. And that's where I've transitioned now in the last 2 years. When we got back to Australia, funny enough, I had my old job at my old place of work come up. It was a position and it was in management. Like, it wasn't a position that you can get, you know, every year. It was quite, once every 4 to 7 years, this might pop up. So it popped up again when I come home. I'm like, oh, it's almost like the devil is tempting me here to go back into a full-time job because it's a secure job, it paid well, et cetera, et cetera. But I made the decision to not do that, even though we're not fully financially independent yet, just because I wanted to do my own thing and I wanted to focus on something else. And that's something else, I didn't quite know exactly what it was, but it has turned out to be a freelance data consultancy company. And that's where I'm putting a lot of my time and effort during the week into. And I work in data and analytics professionally, and I get to solve really fun data-related problems that I was doing regardless of work. I'm always tinkering around, setting environments up, like playing with data, visualizing it. And I'm doing that professionally now. I'm solving problems. I am still getting paid for that, which is awesome. But it's something that I would do anyway. And because it's my own company, I don't have to deal with all the office politics and BS that comes with a traditional corporate job. So that's where I'm at. My wife is currently only working 4 days a week, and she might be dropping to 3 next year. We're still undecided on that. But we are very blessed to be in this position where we've got a decent enough portfolio that's supplementing our income. We aren't tapping into it just yet because we're both still working, but I feel like I'm living a fully financially independent life. The portfolio has just got a few ways to go until it catches up to full FIRE, but that's where we're at and I'm absolutely loving it.
Fantastic. And so your, I guess your life at the moment is, do you sort of do some work every day or is it just basically whenever you want to work, or because it's unstructured, I would have thought?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't directly answer your question. I just realized. So what does a week look like for me? Okay, Monday is one of my favorite days. My wife hates when I say this because she still gets the Sunday night blues a little bit. She's a school teacher. So I wake up Monday and I love Monday because everyone's at work. So the weekends are pretty busy because where we live, where my wife has 3 siblings and we're both the youngest. So we've got plenty of nieces and nephews. So there's always something on. And usually by Sunday night, I'm pretty exhausted. If it's not, you know, partying with friends, it's going to the basketball with the nephews, or, you know, something is on every single week. I wake up Monday and I'm like, everyone's at work, so no one is going to be bugging me. I can just sort of start my day and really get into the groove. I usually make brekkie or make a cuppa for the wife and get breakfast. And then usually Monday I will do a bit of work in the consultancy business. I'll do a little bit of work for Aussie Firebug, like setting up podcasts, maybe write a few articles or start a few articles or whatever it is. Tuesday, at the start of the year, I was going into a place of work, like I was consulting for another business. I would actually go in there on a Tuesday, which was really good. I'm currently working from home full time now, which isn't fantastic. So Tuesday's a bit of the same. To be fair, like most of the week is relatively the same. I usually do like a bit of my data work in the morning, a bit of my Aussie Firebug stuff in the afternoon. I make dinner every night, so I'm head chef at the household.
Oh, nice.
It changes up a little bit. Like I'll go to the gym during the day. That's another thing that I love doing because no one's there. But I'm pretty much home all the time. Weekends we do an adventure, or Friday we do an adventure because the wife's got the day off. And that's about it. Pretty unstructured. Things can pop up. People pop in.
And essentially your data analytics sort of contract work is basically, you know, a company may come up to you and say, yeah, can you have a look at our data? And you do your thing and you just invoice them, essentially.
Yeah. So it's funny that you mentioned that because I started off consulting, but I've actually switched recently to selling a product that I made. Right. And that's been very exciting. And I have sort of a new goal for this decade, the 2020s, and that is to build a small team of 5 to 8 people and to have a bit of a tech startup in my hometown, because I was very, very inspired by the data and tech scene in London, and there was a lot of energy and a lot of people trying to change things, like legitimately having a lot of passion in their work. And I just didn't feel like I had that same environment when I come back to my country town. So that's sort of the goal with this. I've transitioned from like a business to a proper company now, and I'm hoping to build it into something, which is completely not money related at all. It's more of just a personal goal satisfaction thing that I want to achieve.
That's fantastic. And the irony being that by reaching financial independence and what you thought was perhaps working less, you may end up being a little bit more busier than what you were in London. That's the irony.
I had the exact same conversation with my wife. She's like, are you sure you want to actually incorporate and turn it into a proper company? You're probably going to be really busy next year. And I said, yeah, do you know what? I will be. Like, I bet you it will reach a point, because I was just cruising. The last 2 years since we got back from London has been cruise city. It's been really nice. We bought a house. We moved back from London. We got married. We bought a house. It's been big things that we've been doing from a life point of view. But now that the dust has settled and I'm thinking, what do I want to do now? Like, I'm not that worried about money anymore. We've bought a house. That was a big thing that was on my mind. You know, what do I want to achieve? What makes me happy? I can't just sit around the house all day. And this is the next step. And I really, like, I've got this vision of working in like a cool little co-working space in my country town. There's a few popping up, working with some really bright people that are passionate and driven and want to make a difference. And I want to foster that environment as much as possible. And I'm just really excited to see where it goes. It might fail, who cares? Luckily in the space that I'm in, you don't have to outlay a lot of capital to get going. So if it fails, you're pretty much just wasted your time. You didn't waste, you know, it's not like you have to buy a lot of inventory and like rent out warehouses and stuff. So it's very exciting and it gets me out of bed in the morning. And yeah, it's a bit of irony that it's possible next year and the year after I'll be working, you know, maybe 50-hour weeks or something like that. So we'll see where this goes.
On that note, we'll take a quick break. So we'll be right back.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just for a bit of context for my listeners, you're in your early 30s.
33, mate. Ripe old age of 33.
Very young, very young. So you started your FIRE journey focusing primarily on property.
That's correct.
But now you've shifted your focus a little bit more on the stock market, plus or minus your own business. Now, I always say to people, my Vanguard portfolio doesn't ask me to fix the plumbing. I do have a few investment properties, but I'm moving away from that. It was just a bit of a pain in the ass to sort of manage. Was that the main reason why you're switching over from a relatively passive active investment strategy from property to purely passive?
Yeah, pretty much. So I think this is a common theme as well. Like I met a lot of people, I was right into property at the start. And it's funny because I actually had the guy, the second book I ever read about financial independence, and I'm not too sure if you've read it, is Zero to 130 Properties in 3.5 Years by Stephen McKnight. Have you read that one?
I haven't read it, but I've seen it and it's a very famous book, yes.
Yeah, it's very famous. It came out in like 2003. It sold like, I don't know, 200,000 copies or something. Very, very famous book. I actually met Steve McKnight the other week or a week and a half ago for the first time. It was actually the second time, but it was the first time I actually had a proper conversation with him, because the first time I met him was at a conference of his in Melbourne many, many moons ago when I was just starting out. And he was like my guy. He was the guy that I followed, my guru. And I was so in on property back then. My parents were property investors. My aunties and uncles were property investors. Everyone that you meet at footy training at the pub, you know, investing property or somehow related to property. So that's all you sort of know growing up. Well, that's all I knew anyway. And I was into that world, and we got up to three properties, I think, by 2014 or 15. And cut a long story short, essentially, as they weren't too much of a headache, but they were more of a headache than shares were. Or when I eventually discovered shares, there's pros and cons with both asset classes. And I just think that the lifestyle that me and my wife were living and that wanted to live was more suited for shares. And that is what I've seen throughout the years. And back to my original point with like going to the seminars and that, I met people and I'm still friends with some people that I met nearly 10 years ago. And we kept in touch and, you know, shared ideas with property. And a lot of those people have done the same thing. They've moved out of property and are starting to move into shares. And I really think that it's a natural progression for a lot of people because shares is more active. I actually think there is more money to be made in property, to be honest, even though, and I've made on a percentage basis, I've made more money in property than I have, and I'll probably ever will be with like a passive ETF style share portfolio, but it's just more work. And now I'm at the stage where I want to do meaningful work. I don't want to be managing properties. That really doesn't get me out of bed in the morning. So that's the main reason we shifted. And I've seen a lot of other people shift, but I really want to make it clear because I think there is some rhetoric in the FIRE community that shares is somehow superior to property as an investment class. And I don't think that is true. I just think it's horses for courses. It's what are you as an investor more suited towards? And can you bring your skill set into that investment class and make more money that way? And I just don't think, I think majority of Australians are probably not suited to be property investors, but that's all they sort of know. And that's what they're fed mainstream media that, you know, to be rich, you got to invest in property. But I also, on the same token, don't want to dismiss it as a bad investment class or anything, because I really think it has more potential, to be honest, than a passive ETF portfolio. It just, you've got to know how to use it.
Yeah, look, in all fairness, if you bought a property in the 90s, you're doing pretty well. So I don't blame people thinking that property is the golden ticket to your financial independence. I know several people, you know, my parents, you know, parents of my friends and family, they've just done Well, they haven't really done anything. All they've bought is a few homes and all of a sudden they're all quadrupled or quintupled. And, you know, they've just become multimillionaires as a result. So I suppose I can see how people can think that property is the way to go, because that's what the media always talk about. You know, the RBA interest goes up, property prices down by 10%, like every other day. And the other thing is, of course, the power of leverage, you know.
Yes.
You know, for odd purposes, go and buy a house. The bank says, yep, no worries. I'll lend you 80, 90%, 100% of the home loan, no worries. But if you did the same thing with the stock market, they'll laugh you off, which is interesting. And I think this sort of psychology of it is what we've been fed. I think you're quite right. Now, you had a podcast episode about children and raising children. This is going back, I think, a while. This is pre-pandemic. And I guess I wanted to pick your brain about how do children and how do kids, figure in your FIRE journey. I think you have expressed in previous episodes that you may wish to have children, may wish to have a family at some point. And I think in one of your episodes with one of your guests, which was caused outrage in the Aussie FIRE discussion. Do you remember that? This is a few years ago.
I do.
Where essentially, for people that haven't listened to that episode, we're essentially AFB. And I think it was, I don't know who it was on the other side, we're basically talking about cost of raising children. And I think the criticism was, two guys who didn't have kids at the time, I didn't think the other guy had kids, were talking about raising kids in a very frugalistic way and how you can buy third-hand prams and all that sort of stuff. And I think you copped a bit of backlash online.
We did.
So how does children figure in your FIRE journey? Are you worried that now that, you're potentially doing part-time work, you're doing perfect FI, it all sounds really good now, but kids cost money, right? I mean, they cost a lot of money to raise. I call them wealth killers, but you got to love them. I love my kids, but they eat a lot. They cost a lot. How do you plan to cross that bridge if and when it does happen?
Yeah, so this is funny that you brought this up. So the episode was with Pat and Dave. Dave at Strong Money and Pat the Shuffler. And yes, we got some criticism for that episode. And I don't blame them, to be honest. I mean, it was three childless guys talking about the cost of raising children. Yeah, look, it wasn't the best episode, I'll be honest, but I was trying to rein it in. I mean, the point that we were trying to get at in the episode, and I guess you can't, it's hard for people to take you seriously unless you've done something. It would be like, tell you how to shoot a basketball that doesn't know how to shoot a basketball or something like that. So I can understand the outrage, and yes, I copped it in my own group. yeah. So the question with how kids factor in. So yes, we are trying for kids. That's no secret. We do want kids in the future. Me and my wife, definitely. And that will just be an expense that is factored in, you know, like I just don't know how much they're going to cost. And this is the thing, and I think this is the point we were getting at in the podcast, was it is so different, the costs. If you look at people's examples, like the cost of raising children depends on so many factors and varies so greatly that it's really hard for me to sort of do any future budgeting. I think the way we're approaching it is it will be whatever it will be. Like, so hopefully we have kids and obviously they're going to be an expense. We will take that as it comes and adjust accordingly. So obviously the portfolio, the FI number will have to go up, and we will just take that in stride and put more snow on the snowball and see how it goes. I guess it's just I'm looking forward to tracking that and sharing that with the community, because I think, like, who knows? I could be surprised. I just think that there maybe is some areas where you could save money. But again, I don't have kids, so we will see how it will go for us.
The biggest factor with having kids is emotion. And I think I remember when we got pregnant first, and I've got two young kids, and we went to Baby Bunting. Baby Bunting is a, you know, pretty big baby shop in Victoria, and I think, I'm not sure whether they have it interstate. And, I'm going to be a first-time father, and my wife's going to be a first-time mother, and we're expecting, we're all excited. And we walked into the shop and, you know, at the time I had a reasonably good income. I was saving a lot of money. I was investing already. So it's not as if that I was new to money. But you walk into the shop and they say, oh, we'll provide you with a consultant for your shopping experience. Now, I mean, I thought that was just normal. So I just went, okay, well, give us a consultant. And she was very nice. She took us every step of the way in terms of what we would need from a neonate up to a 10-year-old. Everything from beds and Manchester and bloody toys and prams, you know, car seats and everything. So about $7,000 later at the end of the day, that was we were at the sort of $6,500 or $7,000 later. We sort of realized that we'd sort of bought things we probably didn't need, like a nappy disposal system. I mean, do we really need a nappy disposal system? Yes, it's great. You know, do we really need a car seat that lasts for about 3 months and then you got to swap it over? Well, you can just buy the one that lasts you for longer. So then we started cutting it down. And it's that emotional factor that a lot of people, you know, don't factor in, because, you know, it is your flesh and blood and you want to do the right thing and you want to do the best. And I remember when we bought the bed, we actually bought a really expensive cot, which transformed into a double bed eventually. So that bed lasted us several years. So that was actually a pretty good investment. And we actually sold it. It was a Buri brand. And we actually sold it for a significant price, which, you know, didn't almost meet the cost price, but it was a significant benefit for us to do. That was a great investment. Prams. I'm always shocked how expensive
Same.
Prams are.
I couldn't believe it when people told me.
And I'm like, well, what the hell is this? This is like the Mercedes-Benz of prams versus a Rolls-Royce versus a bloody Kia. You know, do you want three wheels, four wheels? I'm like, oh, shit. You know, there's so much... so much into it. And of course, car seats. So, you know, car seats really important. It's got to be, you know, 5-star rating and this and that. So there's a lot of things that you can easily spend money on. And I think it's the emotional thing that a lot of people don't factor that into account. I mean, we could have easily cut it down by 90% if we wanted to, you know, buying secondhand stuff, etc. But yeah, and our kids, I don't know, like you got to love them. You know, every time I see my children, I'm like, you know what? You're probably going to cost me, you know, $5-6 million in my net worth, but I love you.
Do you know what, Dev? I think we're going to fall prey to this as well. I say prey, but like, you know, it's just emotions, because I know the tactics that a lot of people are going to use. Like you want the best for your baby, don't you? You want the best, right? And it's like, yeah. I want the best. Of course I want the best for my baby, but you pay the extra for the best. And I'm human, and I just think that, and it's so different when it's someone else as well. Like for me personally, I was the king of being as tight as possible for myself. You know, I was never, I tried not to be cheap. Like cheap is distinctly different to frugal. Like if you go to a wedding and you give them some chocolate for their wedding gift, okay, that's cheap. You know, that's not frugal, that's cheap. I was the king of being frugal for myself. If I could make meals for $1.50 and I could make like 20 of them and freeze them all and they wouldn't taste that great and it didn't matter, like I would just do that. But that's just for myself. As soon as you introduce another person into the equation, and that probably starts with a partner, like you have to you have to give and take to have a good relationship, you know. And now if you bring a baby into this world, all right, that changes the game completely again. Even though I haven't gone through it, this is what I've heard and read. So I think that we will most likely crumble to the society pressures of, you know, getting the baby the best and everything. It's going to be an interesting journey. I'm looking forward to documenting it and to experiencing it myself. But it will be interesting, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be an experience, you know, but
it's interesting how society is structured for certain things at a much more efficient level. So to give you an example, to go on a holiday as a couple, it's relatively easy. You pay for flights and pay for one room and there's a double bed and Bob's your uncle. Then you go on a holiday with one child and you sort of very quickly figure out, okay, well, the hotel rooms are not really structured for three people. They're kind of structured for maybe four people with double beds. So then you have to pay a little bit more to get that hotel room with two double beds for four people. Then you have two children and you go, oh, that's, you know, some hotel rooms are optimized, but now you might need an extra ensuite, might need two rooms. And then you start having three children.
Then you go, well, actually, now I have to get two of everything, and maybe two rooms or three rooms, even an apartment. Then everything sort of escalates because that's just the accommodation. Then you got to get a taxi. Then all of a sudden you realize, okay, if I have three kids, I need to get a bigger taxi rather than a smaller taxi. If I have four kids, I need to get a van, you know, all that sort of stuff. So everything sort of escalates quite significantly. Now, I'm really looking forward to you documenting that. It's a good thing to leave a little bit of a blueprint for the FIRE community as well. And certainly reflecting on my experience with children, I think I would have done things a lot differently. And I think we did, you know, spend a lot more money than what we probably should have. But has it really broken the bank? Probably not. But, you know, that's just being able to be lucky to be able to do
it. I have a question for you, Dev. Sorry to cut you off, mate. Just on this topic of children, because this is – my mind is more interested in these sort of topics these days than, you know, the financial independence stuff, which is funny. But one of the things that I'm almost dreading to have to go through, it's many years away, but like – so you have two young kids. How do you – have you run into the situation – I'm sure you have – where things start to creep into your children's lives that are outside of your control, like their friends getting, I'm going to use my nephews as an example here, $8,500 downhill mountain bikes. And now they come to dad and say, my friends have got this awesome giant electric mountain bike. You know, I want one too. They're all got it. They're all riding around. All my friends are doing it. You know, get me a mountain bike, dad. And I don't want the POV one because people will tease me. How do you approach that situation?
It's a very good question. So exposure to children outside of your control is around the 60-70% mark, everything from TV to schooling to outside world exposure. So it's becoming harder as my children do grow up. It was a lot easier when they were younger because they kind of didn't realize, you know, having a really expensive bike or whatever was a big deal, whatever. So what I've generally tended to do since they were born is, I know this sounds really bad, but the default answer is no. And when they did ask for something, you know, they made sure that they, you know, really needed it and really wanted it. What's happened though, I've got an elder daughter who's just entering high school, is that that's becoming harder and harder to do. So, you know, we've sort of caved in the last sort of couple of years and ended up, you know, getting her the most expensive iPhone, something max, whatever it is, because, you know, she said, I really need it at school because, you know, I can easily transfer it, you know, between the computers at school and my phone. Okay, fine. Then obviously the next step is, okay, well, the whole school computer systems are Apple products. So, you know, dad, I think I really need a MacBook Pro. So now she's got a MacBook Pro on top of it to go with her iPhone. So it becomes really tricky. And I don't think there's an easy way for it. Now, I don't want to be the guy that's constantly telling my kids they can't have, you know, what they want. But it's got to be within reason. So, and I'm also very, very fortunate because of the way that they've been brought up, they don't actually ask for outlandish things. So, you know, even with, you know, things like smartphones and computers, that's, you kind of need that for schooling, where she, a lot of her work that she does is, you know, remote learning was a big thing. So having that MacBook Pro was very useful. And, you know, she does a lot of stuff online. I mean, most kids now are communicating via emails. The teachers are uploading onto Google Drive. There's a lot of that sort of sharing. So you kind of need tech products. Now, does she need a MacBook Pro? Can it be done with an average Lenovo laptop? Absolutely. So how do you approach that? I think we've sort of had a default sort of answer of no during the younger years, but we are finding it that it's more and more difficult to do. And I reflect on my experience growing up, you know, in the 90s, Air Jordans were a thing. You know, I was an excellent tennis player, so getting a Prince racket was a big thing for me. So now we're at a different level in 2022. It's mainly around tech. But they've been relatively good. Like we don't drive a massively flashy car. Some of her school friends, you know, come in a really expensive car. My kids have never actually asked me, hey, why can't we have a really flashy car? They've never actually said that. And I think the reason they haven't said it is because right from the get-go, we've made sure that we've told both of them. I mean, the younger ones, you know, quite, it's only in prep at the moment, but the older one for sure, we've sort of told them nothing should be taken for granted. I'm a first generation immigrant. Nothing should be taken for granted. And if you really want or need something, it's okay to plan for it, save for it, and buy it. That's completely fine. Now, we are very lucky now that, you know, when we do spend money, you know, going holidays, etc., we do spend a lot of money. But they never say, you know, why can't we stay at a seven-star hotel? They never say it outright, because I think they realise that they've been brought up in a way that, you know, make sure that you don't take anything around you for granted, because, you know, times are tough for everyone, and I instill it in them. So we actually don't, my expenses, AFB has been relatively the same over the last sort of 5 to 10 years. The biggest expense for us at the moment is our schooling, which in your fire discussion, there's always someone that posts public versus
private. That's
another
hot topic. That is a hot topic as well.
I'm going to be honest and say that we do send our kids to private school, and it does cost $70,000, $75,000, and probably will end up costing about $100,000 for both of them by the time they finish per year. But, you know, that's something that we do, and we've decided to do that. Do they really need to do it? Probably not. I went to public school and I turned out okay. But that would be the biggest expense for us. And they didn't choose to do that. We chose to do that for them. And it's sort of so far so good. But yeah. So that's a topic that always, I think recently someone posted on your thing about private versus public, and it's heated
that
topic.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to hear you, Dev, say that your children don't ask for that much now anyway, which is really awesome to hear, because if they're going to such a prestigious school that costs that much money, I'd imagine they're mixing and hanging out with other children that have extreme luxury in their life, no doubt. So I think that's just a testament to you guys as parents as well, because I definitely, even though I don't have kids, I took some cues from my parents growing up. I've got some funny stories with my dad. You know, people think that I'm a tight ass, you know, should meet my old man. But that definitely rubbed off, and those values were instilled into me. I just find this whole area, though, of the marketing machine and getting people to buy things that they don't need very fascinating. It's extremely fascinating, and it's almost at the core of the FIRE movement, that rejection of consumerism and buying things that you don't need because it doesn't actually enrich your life. And I think it's really interesting. There's a couple of really great books about how humans, we are signaling animals. That has been in our DNA for hundreds of thousands of years. If you look at how people lived for centuries, you know, we were always wearing necklaces, rings. We wanted to show off our wealth. And there are some like evolutionary traits that come with that. And it's really interesting that in the 21st century, the marketing machine has really tapped into that part of our brain that hasn't changed that much in the last 200,000 years. And people continue to buy stuff that they don't need to show off wealth that they don't have, to impress people that they don't even like just about. And it's an issue. And I think part of the FIRE community is fighting back. So I'm pleased to hear that you know, your kids have some rejection of that consumerism already at this age.
Yeah, and it will get big. It will get more and more difficult as they become older. There are some things that we don't compromise on, and it's probably worthwhile me saying this and being open and honest about it. So I'm very lucky to have a very high income. And I'm not pretending to be poor by any means. And there's some things we don't compromise on. So, for example, we've decided to spend a lot of money on education. When we go on holidays, we spend a lot of money. So everything from airfares to hotels to experiences. We live in a really big house, and we're very lucky to be able to do that. And when we budget for stuff and we spend for stuff, you know, we don't borrow any money. So I just spend money that I have. And when we, you know, our cars are not the most expensive cars, but they have a really good safety rating. I'm really concerned about my family's safety. So I wouldn't buy a car that does not have a 5-star ANCAP safety rating or some sort of safety rating that for European standards or US standards. So I wouldn't buy a car that's cheap and has a low safety rating. So those are all non-negotiables. But having said that, I don't have a Rolex watch because I don't even have a watch. And I have a, you know, basic iPhone. that I got as part of a continuing medical education. So we're allowed to buy tech products as part of that. So I don't go out of my way to sort of spend exorbitant amounts of money. But there are some non-negotiables in our lives where we want to make sure that, you know, there are some basics. But I always tell my family is that we're only here today because, you know, there are some things that I did, you know, when I was in medical school and when I was an intern, when I was a resident, I was really, really stingy. So I always tell my kids, you know, myself and your mum are only here today because of all the things that we did 10 yep. years ago. You can't have it both ways. So they absolutely realised that what we have today is a foundation of what's happened 10 years ago. And I think it's really important that kids understand that, because if they don't understand it, they think yeah. it's normal. And this is not normal. And I think we make it very, very clear to them that, you know, mum and dad have worked very hard and we're very stingy and we've invested all this money 10, 12, 15 years ago so that we can have a life today that, you know, not super privileged or anything, but we're very comfortable. And I think that's really, really important. Now, that's it for part one. Next week, we'll continue part two of this chat, where I ask Aussie Firebike more questions around debt, investing, and private health insurance, and of course, fire. Catch you next week.
We acknowledge the Awabakal people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.